Committee on Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Law called to order. The first item today will be a work session on House Bill 2766. Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2766, you have the dash three amendments in front of you, and they replace the other amendments, and they also replace the bill. The dash three amendments relate to community corrections. Under community corrections, under what was called Senate Bill 1145 from the 1995 legislative session, the state of Oregon assumed responsibility prior to 1995. The state was responsible for people convicted of felonies, the counties for misdemeanors. After that, what they did is determination was made based on the length of sentence. If you received a sentence of under 12 months or under, you went to the community corrections. If you were there because you were a felon, the state helped the counties by paying money for those people there. They helped build jail space and money to supervise and house these people. And there was a base funding amount established at that time, a current service level. In front of you, you have the dash three amendments, which set a different formula for funding and reimbursing the counties. We have, we have Craig Campbell, Paul Snyder, and Ginger Martin here, who can probably better explain it. But going through the bill, what you will see here is beginning in 2006 and every 6 years thereafter, this is on page 1, line 19, the Department of Corrections shall conduct a study of the actual costs of providing management support services and supervision and sanctions to the offenders described, and that's basically the offenders that go to community corrections. And then it calls on the next page for adjustments based every 6 years based on the costs, 24 months as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The reason I was down to LFO is the original bill has a referral to Ways and Means Committee. The amendment actually doesn't kick in to have a fiscal impact until next biennium. Nonetheless, LFO is anticipating this bill, and they have suggested that the bill be referred to the House Budget Committee because it will have a fiscal in the falling biennium, and they need to, I guess, build a future budget along those lines.
Okay. Mr. Snyder, did you? We'll take some brief testimony on this this morning.
They want to bring up Ginger Martin, Craig Campbell, too.
Ginger Martin, Craig Campbell, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Just a couple of comments about the dash three amendments. The reference in the dash threes, just as in the dash twos, is to a capitated rate. That's not a self-defining term. And what that means is it refers to basically a process that's already in place that's being used by the Department of Corrections for purposes of distributing the money to the counties. And what it consists of is two general categories. One is people on probation. The other is people who are either on parole or post-prison supervision. Those categories are broken down then into bands that relate to the level of risk each offender presents. And each of those bands goes from high to low or limited, and there's a local control group as well. Each of these bands has a number in the population of offenders that fits within that band. It also has a dollar figure associated with what's the estimated cost of, actual cost of providing that service. And so what this would do would be to adopt that particular rate for purposes of building the budget as well as for purposes of distributing the money. And this would take place then following a cost study of actual county costs of delivering the services. That study would be done in 2006. The results of that study would be used to fit new dollar figures into that capitated rate that already exists. And the population forecast would be used to fit in the new population figures for that. There's a reference in line 23 of the Dash 3 amendments to the results of the study would be used to adjust capitated rates. They would also be used, I believe, to build that first budget for purposes of appropriating money. As I said, it's already being used for purposes of distributing the money. Mr. Chair, that's all I have to
say. Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Tucker?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, Governor's Senior Policy Advisor. I just wanted to comment that the amendments you see before you reflect the work of a variety of different interest groups around the community corrections system, and these reflect an agreement as to the direction we need to go forward, and it's intended to capture as accurately as possible the fluctuation and growth in local costs associated with doing community corrections. And we look at this as kind of a critical piece to making sure that we at the state level are making a good faith effort to reflect what those increased costs are over time.
Okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I will just add one additional thought. The folks who deliver community corrections in the counties see this method of building the budget as a more stable and predictable method than our current one. Our current method also includes a correctional forecast of populations and a costing out of those populations, but the two populations vary in size, and one of the populations is very small, hard to predict, and drives a level of fluctuation in the budget that's difficult to manage. This particular method continues to use correctional forecasting, but divides the population into larger groups that are easier to predict and will create a more stable funding mechanism for community corrections.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any questions for anybody? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2766.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2766 as amended to the full committee with a due pass.
Okay, with the recommendation of the House budget.
Oh, with the recommendation referral, of the House budget. Referral to the House budget.
Aye.
Lieutenant Bolton?
Aye.
Lieutenant Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Representative Thatcher carried that. Okay, we're waiting. Oh, he's here. Never mind. Not Miss Heidemo and Dick Bill Taylor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, because I was thinking we were in the hall. We're not. No.
Andy, I'm still not sure because I took in both of your versions, and so I'm still not sure based on, I mean, the way that this was edited, it didn't make grammatical sense, so I tried to make grammatical sense out of it, but I'm sure that there are still issues.
Everybody's had the opportunity to read this.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has had the opportunity to read this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're on board with.
Well, I just did the newest new version. The newest new. I'm ready whenever you are.
I'm ready for that.
Okay. That's gone.
Okay.
That would not. That would not. Okay.
You call.
I'm happy to do introductory.
Okay, 4-4. Yes. 4-4.
This is shared. This is shared. I think, isn't he like a firearms guy? So I would do 1-1-1 and 2-2-2, or you could bring up the gun guys first, whatever. But that's how I'd group them.
Okay.
Did you gavel in?
I did. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2768. Rod Harder, Justin Steiner, and Kevin Sterrett, please.
And Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I will just give the committee a little bit of background about the materials that I just handed out to you. House Bill 2768 is being amended. It is being replaced entirely by the amendments, so the original content of the bill is not something that we will be discussing. But essentially, what we're doing here is shoring up some of the concealed handgun license laws. As I believe most of you know, in order to get the concealed handgun license process is one by which if a person meets these various standards listed in ORS 166.291, the county sheriff must give a concealed handgun license to the applicant. It has come to our attention that the sheriffs then are required by statute to give concealed handgun licenses to people who might otherwise be prohibited from possessing a firearm under federal law. And while we did not feel it was appropriate to simply insert the federal statute into the state statute and have what is essentially a lockstep provision, we did feel that there were a few things we could add to this, including that the person is not an unlawful user of or addicted to a controlled substance, has never been dishonorably discharged from the armed forces, and is not required to register as a sex offender in any state. You can go down then, and I'm looking at the handout that I just passed out to you, which is not an official version of amendments. It's the thing I just gave you. It's just a typed up. This is what I'm proposing to send down to LC, although I'll get to another section in a moment that may need some additional tweaking. But if you go down to subsection 9 in 161.291, you have the definition of what a unlawful user or addicted to controlled substance means. And what we decided in a work group was that if within the 4 years prior to the application, the person has either had two or more official law enforcement reports that documented an incident involving their use of a controlled substance, or the person admitted to an addiction to a controlled substance, or the person participated in a court-supervised drug diversion program, that would take them out of the ability to get a concealed handgun license. But again, as I pointed out, that's just a four-year deal. In 166.293, the denial or revocation of license, there are some circumstances where a sheriff can revoke or deny an application besides these lists in 166.291. This is the section or sections that need, I think, some additional tweaking, specifically subsection 2 here. Representative Olson has been working very hard with the various stakeholders to get some language everyone can live with. I tried to tweak it based on his edits of a recent version, but I think it's probably still needs a little bit of work. But in any event, we have done a few tweaks there. And then the final thing that we did in 166.295 is we have taken a piece of, I believe it in the House chamber, it's Representative Boquist's bill that would allow an member of the armed forces to renew by mail every 4 years if they're an active member and they submit the proof of their military orders and military identification.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up a little bit what staff mentioned, how you said, there has been a lot of work from everybody involved on the one section dealing with see if I can get it here. Be on the same page. It's 166-293 regarding the denial or revocation. And specifically subsection 2, notwithstanding ORS 166. If you can go down to about the middle of that paragraph, what the correct wording should be, and I'll start, of this section, a sheriff may deny a concealed handgun license if the sheriff has reasonable grounds to believe that the applicant has been or is reasonably likely to be in danger to self or others or to the community at large as a result of the applicant's mental or psychological state or as demonstrated by past pattern of behavior involving unlawful violence or threats of unlawful violence. And that was the wording that we all came to agreement on.
Okay, so it looks like what we would do is just remove that, or the applicant's participation in incidents, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and that would be part of the dash four amendments. That
correct.
Okay, please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Justin Sterner. I'm 19 Delta in E Troop from the 82nd Cavalry and an Army National Guard. I'm a single father of two girls. Recently, I had my handgun permit revoked from me by mail, certified mail, by Lieutenant David Radar, who states that I am a threat to myself and a danger to other people. I'd like to say that I have never committed a crime of violence towards another human being where I have been convicted of anything. I have defended on a few occasions myself and my children, never using or pulling or even possessing my weapon during the time of the incident until just recently, where I had it was 5/4/2005, about 20:35 a.m. or p.m. I was on my way home from my children and my fiance, they were jogging at the park, and we were stopped at a light, and a gentleman flipped his cigarette out the window, and I said to the gentleman, "Put that in your ashtray, that's where it belongs." He then flipped me the bird, took a left-hand turn, and as I took my left-hand turn, he started throwing coke out his window, where he was trying to get it on my truck. I didn't make the right judgment call. I followed him to his house, got out of my truck, told him a few choice words, and he started to call the police. His wife had came out of her apartment, and I turned around without ever having an incident with this gentleman, no fist thrown, nothing of that nature, just a few choice words, returned back to my truck, and noticed that my pistol had fallen on the ground from under my seat of my truck. My daughters, 12, and my other daughter of 10, and my fiance were all in the truck, watched me as I got out of the truck, had brushed it with my foot from under the seat, and knocked it to the ground. I picked it up, put it in my truck, drove home. Approximately 5 minutes later, I had two officers at my door, an officer Tim Palke and an officer Paul Kennard. The officer Tim Palke spoke with me for a minute or so, and then asked to see my pistol, my Ruger 9mm, which I went into the garage, retrieved for him with my concealed handgun permit, went outside. He wanted to know how it got into play. It was never in play. It fell from my truck to the ground and was put back in there as I drove away. I showed the officer by opening my door, showing him it, my pistol also sits in a holster, and it never came out of the holster or at any time was removed from the holster. I showed him how it had been knocked out, and my daughters verified this to the officer. At this point, the other officer, Paul, said that there was a report had come out in the morning that their commander had given them, stating that a green truck with a white gentleman with a pistol had been seen 2 days prior to this, pointing an aiming weapon, and therefore they were taking my pistol from me. I said that it wasn't me. I was not the character they were looking for. And at this point, that they were not to remove my pistol from my property. It was now back in the garage, by the way. where the officers insisted on removing my pistol and my handgun permit from my property. I had committed no crime. This pistol was never in any part of this incident. Other than it had fallen to the ground, I am guilty of that. Upon this, I said, you guys can take me to jail if you'd like, or you can get a warrant to remove the property from my home. And they said that they didn't need it, and he cuffed me up in front of my two children and my fiance and put me in the back of his squad car where I sat. And then the officers proceeded to tell me that because of the incident and because I fit a description that was put out that morning in a memo, that they were taking my pistol from me. And I denied them the right to enter my house to remove my pistol and handgun permit from my property. He then shut the door, said he's had enough of this, and he went over and started badgering my fiance, who also is here, and my 12-year-old daughter. My 10-year-old had went in the house. This was too much for her. I think the officers made very bad judgment calls. I think that they abused their power and walked on some of my amendment rights. The ultimate thing that happened here is, after about 10 minutes of them badgering my fiance and my daughter, I said, fine, take the pistol. And we also had an understanding that it was for safekeeping only and that I would receive it back the following Wednesday, which would have been the 18th, I believe. I since then have called the officer 5 or 6 times at the precinct, each precinct, made contact with him actually twice out of the 6 times that I have left messages for him, and he still has my pistol to this day. And they are considering charging me for whatever, I don't know. I have talked to the district attorney. He said he's reading the information over, the police report, the incident itself, and that he will get a hold of me Friday and either give my pistol back to me or charge me with whatever they're going to charge me with. I have made no contact. I physically did not beat this guy, anything of this nature. I have in the past had a couple run-ins where I defended my girls and my mother, which is a girl's grandmother, from a guy who rear-ended us on purpose because I pulled out of a parking lot and he had to slow down for me, and it was a case of road rage where he approached our car after he ran into us from behind. I stepped out of the car. I told him to get in his car and to back off of my car because he came right up to my front window yelling and screaming. Very hostile individual. Luckily, there was a police officer right there at this instant. He turned on his lights and the whole thing was defused, and the lieutenant, David Radar, had called me in for that incident and told me that if I ever had another incident that I would be revoked. And on the 12th, I was revoked, and I have never been charged with any crime or anything of that nature. So I think that the police sometimes overstep their boundaries or take things to their own personal views instead of what the laws state. And that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you. And that we can't really do anything about that because we're not the Portland Police Internal Affairs. I'm sure you understand and appreciate Absolutely. Your story. And I guess the Multnomah County Sheriff, that's who's doing the denial.
Correct. Okay. And the East Precinct that I'm dealing with now. But it just goes to show that given the too much power, that they would use their personal views to revoke the rights of people who have committed no crimes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Starrett?
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. First, I want to thank all the people who worked to put this together, especially committee counsel. I know it had to be a lot of work, and it wasn't very easy. There are still amendments that we haven't seen, so I don't want to make a blanket statement, but of what we have seen, I still have some of the concerns that we had going in. And what those deal with are the possibility that some of this language, no matter how well-intentioned, may be misinterpreted and used incorrectly. And unfortunately, that's happening now. As it is now, I can name numerous instances of sheriff's departments who either don't understand the law or have willfully ignored it. In Marion County here, they were telling applicants that they couldn't apply for a pistol license until they'd lived in the county for 6 months. And this was the result of Marion County Sheriff's misreading the law. And I believe it was 1993 or 1995 in this very room when the law was changed that discussed an applicant could be a U.S. citizen or a legal resident alien who lived in the county for 6 months. And at the time, I pointed out that that would probably be misunderstood, and even some of my colleagues in the gun lobby thought I was crazy, but the committee agreed and changed it to A, U.S. citizen, B, legal resident alien. Marion County Sheriff never understood this. And when we brought it to their attention, after somewhat hostile exchanges, they did contact me and say, that's correct, and we're going to change it. About a year later, they'd gone back to that policy. We've had instances in Lynn and Lane County are telling people that their only references they can use must live within the county. Now, when they've been questioned about this, they do revise it and say, well, we'll accept references from outside the county, but if you're simply reading their requirements, that's what you would think with the case. In Washington County, as you know, we had one of our members was arrested and charged with having a gun on school property. Well, it's not a crime. And it was months later before he got his permit back at quite a lot of legal expense to him. In Clackamas County, although it isn't really a violation of the law, they changed their policy of issuing renewal notices, but they didn't tell anybody. So if you had, as I have, had a pistol license in that county for years and come to expect to get renewal notices, you don't get them anymore. You're suddenly riding around with an expired permit. And the only reason I bring this up is because I've discussed this with the Clackamas County Sheriff, and they're not interested in changing the policy. And my point by bringing this up is to indicate that not every sheriff's department, unlike the gentleman who we sat down with, are particularly friendly towards gun owners. We've had very, very few gun bills move out of this side of the building for the understandable concerns about what might happen when they get to the other side of the building. And so from the beginning, we've had some concerns about this bill and where it might go. And I understand there have been some discussions with your colleagues on the other side of the building that this bill would stay in its present form. I obviously, coming from where I come from, would prefer to see that written in blood somewhere. But point by point on the amendments as we have them, a lot of the things that the sheriffs have wanted, we understand their motivation, but I have real concerns with possible interpretations. For example, changing a principal residence to the person's principal residence, given our experience with some misinterpretations that have taken place, that this could very well develop into something where a person who simply has two homes might be denied a license in the state because they may have a summer place or rather a winter place in Arizona, or there would be a multiple residence for whatever reason. And obviously, if we didn't have such a tight lock on non-resident licenses, that might not be much of an issue, but there it is. The other thing that we had a problem with, which we discussed at length, was we have no interest in seeing drug users getting concealed handgun licenses, but the definition of drug user kind of made us a little nervous, because if someone's involved in a diversion program, that's documented. We're fine with that. But official law enforcement documentation about incidents, frankly, not being a police officer, I don't know what that would entail. And if a person, as we brought up at our meetings, if a person hasn't been charged with a drug crime, then I don't know of any precedent that we have that we could take away their right to have something, because in the absence of any conviction of a crime. I know we've talked to Representative Olson about changing the language about pattern of behavior, meaning more than one incident, and I think the gentleman who just testified is a good example of why this is a concern to us. I believe Representative Barker, the first time, I don't actually remember meeting, but we were together at KATU, yeah, and it was fairly unpleasant, and I frankly drew a firearm to get out of the parking lot. If this law is changed to one incident, I'm sure a lot of people would be very happy to see my license revoked. Now, the language about the dishonorable discharge seems fine with us. At the time, I questioned it because I didn't know what was required to get a dishonorable discharge, but I've been informed that especially nowadays, it's pretty severe. Yeah. And so a person who's been dishonorably discharged in all likelihood is probably not the kind of person you want to give a CHL to. Those are our principal concerns with that. I'm very pleased that the forces work together to try and get this renewed by mail for the military people, because this is something that's been important to us, primarily because those guys have no choice. There's nothing else they can do, and I appreciate all the work that was done to get those amendments in. But until we can address these other issues, especially the multiple incidents and the definition of drug user, we're going to have to kind of be on record as opposing the bill.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, representative of the National Rifle Association in Oregon. Like Mr. Sterrett, we worked very hard on this bill, and especially thank Council and Representative Wilson for the efforts they put forth. Had the same concerns with regards to what constitutes an official law enforcement report, and I've given Representative Olson a list of our concerns, and perhaps he can ask those questions of the sheriffs when they get here, and we can reconcile that. Aside from that, our primary concern, and this issue has been in place for 15 years, and I think this is about the fifth time I've had to address it, and that's with regards to a threat or a pattern of behavior. And as I understand, the next amendment will take place, it will revert to current law and will only add the word or. So that, when we see that, then I think that we are going to be okay with the rest of the bill. But I can't go on record as supporting it until I actually see that. I've been here too long to go there. All due respect to Mr. Sterrett's support of the by mail for military members, my amendment was better, but they liked his, so I'll have to go along with that. But it is something we have to do. We owe it to the folks over there who are putting their life on the line. It's a very small thing. And with those comments, I'll answer any questions if I could do that.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the panel?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Sheriff Dotson and Sheriff Wolf.
And
sheets wasn't
okay. 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 That'll be fine.
Barker and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dennis Dotson. I'm the Lincoln County Sheriff. The information you've heard, as Rob won't repeat that, a couple of comments. The gentleman from the National Guard and some of Mr. Sterry's concerns, I'd like to remind the committee of what you're probably already aware of. That once a sheriff denies or revokes, an individual has the right to appeal to a circuit court, and the judge can make a determination. If the individual prevails, the sheriff's office pays for that, so there's no cost to the individual. But I think that's an important piece that we need to consider. As for the language, the sheriffs are pleased with that. We also appreciate the efforts of everyone involved in it, the representatives from the gun lobbies, that we understand the concerns, and you know, just wanted to assure the committee there's no hidden agenda that the sheriffs, at least the sheriffs that have been involved in this process, have. The definition of, as far as drug use, what constitutes an official report, or what constitutes an incident, it would be an official law enforcement report, unless Sheriff Wolf has something he'd like to add to that. But it would be something that's documented. Not the opinion of a police officer. I know in our work groups that was discussed. Would it be that? Is it a possibility? But no, we want some documentation as well. Again, because we know, and we many of the sheriffs have experience with these denials and revocations being challenged and appealed to the circuit court. We don't necessarily want to do something that we feel is not going to be supported by the court, and we end up paying for it.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Wolf. I'm the sheriff of Polk County, and I'm also the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Our appreciation for the efforts of Representative Olson and the members that have been working on this. We've been in several meetings and have hashed out quite a few things. With the current amendments that are before the committee today and the discussions that we've been having, the Sheriff's Association would be in support of the bill. As far as the issues of some sheriffs do things certain ways and some sheriffs do things other ways, I'll have to give to you the fact that there are 36 individual sheriffs of this state. And as the president of the association, I even find at times when we get together on issues, it's kind of like herding cats at times. But the fact is that there are procedures that are in place if there is an appeal. Past patterns of behavior are a situation in which most sheriffs, and particularly out of my county, we would actually conduct a full investigation of an incident to make sure that the information is not just hearsay, or we have an angry spouse, or we have an upset boyfriend, or whatever the case may be. We end up getting official reports, and for the purposes of what the sheriffs would consider an official report would be a police report that is written by a law enforcement agency, and then the sheriff who is the ultimate authority to deny. There is no one else in the agency or city police agency that can deny. They can seize the CHL, but they have no authority other than the sheriff of that county to deny that. And so the sheriff at that point would then review the official reports based off of the information that he has before him, and then try to make a logical, reasonable decision. And in my case, I've actually personally contacted individuals before I've made a revocation. And we are required to submit to them in writing what that revocation is and what it's based off of. And I have had a case overturned in Polk County Circuit Court myself, but it was under current language in which I was not a qualified expert to determine the psychological or mental state of an individual. And I accepted that. I understood that. But the past patterns of behavior of this particular individual, showing up in multiple police reports where domestic violence was an issue, where he was arrested but then later charges dismissed, the fact that this individual had multiple encounters and was also at the scene of several other incidents in which there were fights, based off of the past pattern of behavior, I took the issue before the court. And the letter from the court used current language. However, I have had discussions with the judge after that, and he specifically said this issue should come before this legislature in order to give the sheriff the authority to use patterns of behavior, because he felt that the patterns of behavior were such that he would have upheld it had he had that language. Unless there's other questions from the committee?
Are there any other questions?
I actually have, yes, Mr. Chair. And this question is addressed to both sheriffs. I want to kind of just go back a little bit and get your perspective on official police records or reports, since that seems to be still somewhat of a hot item, and just to kind of get a little bit of history recorded on this right now. And the first thought is, as you know, that two or more official law enforcement reports that document incidents involving a person's unlawful use of controlled substances is a piece of this bill. From your perspective, what is an official police report, law enforcement report?
I would consider an official law enforcement report a report that's actually written by an officer that's part of the official recordings of the sheriff's office or a law enforcement agency. In our case, Speaking for Polk County, an official police report would be one that we enter into our records management system that shows an event and or a case number, and then that report becomes a matter of record for our office.
And Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I would concur with that. In addition to that, it may be an official report of an individual during investigation and interview where a person reveals that they are a drug user, that they are addicted to the drug, and that is documented. You know, we'd want to also hopefully the officer would pursue that, but if not, if such a person applied for a concealed handgun license, we would pursue further to determine, to try to corroborate that in some fashion.
Okay. Further, Mr. Chair,
you mentioned Sheriff Wolf regarding the records management system, and Mr. Harder and I had a little bit of discussion about this earlier too, and I'm just reflecting back on what the Oregon State Police did at one time for records, and Sheriff Dawson, this might also trigger a thought for you too as well, but the not all cases have or incidents that are formal reports are that involve drug-related incidents are actually end up turning out to be a report. But, for example, a citation for someone being cited for less than an ounce, would you consider that as part of being an official report?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that yes, I would, because it actually is an incident in which the agency took an official action. I would consider a citation for possession or domestic violence issues such as those an official report.
And that would be entered into your records management system?
Yes, it is. In our office, it is.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a few more that I have here. One of the questions I guess that needs to kind of surface a little bit is through the investigation, dealing with this, does the law enforcement officer have to view the subject using a controlled substance?
I say not.
Okay. Could you maybe explain a little bit more, though?
The officers respond to a variety of calls, totally unrelated to drugs. They enter into residences, places of business. They have opportunities to observe the interiors of motor vehicles. They have opportunity to contact individuals on the street, for example. And through the interview or investigative process, they either observe indications of drug use or drug possession or an admission that is offered. They didn't necessarily see the individual use the drugs. Is this getting to what you were asking
about? Yeah, actually, I mean, what you're willing to do is just basically, what I'm thinking of is the development of probable cause to take, you know, obviously, I mean, there's lots of times where officers don't see the act itself, but as a result of probable cause and evidence that they collect and everything, it's a easy bridge then to conclude that that's exactly what was going on.
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Olson, again, my statement earlier was that I find it difficult to imagine, but it no doubt has occurred, that sheriffs want to go before a judge in a circuit court, try to defend their position, and not have something that the court is going to accept as a preponderance of the evidence. Whether the court standard is going to be beyond reasonable doubt or something else, you know, that's going to go depend upon the judges. But there is a standard that the courts do use statewide. And the sheriffs, if they don't know it, they should know it. And they're taking a terrible chance of losing their position if they're not prepared to defend, yes, this revocation was based upon this information that this individual was either in possession or using drugs.
Okay. Just final, Mr. Chair. So what is your thoughts then on hearsay toward any... I mean, obviously, hearsay is going to be more likely not substantiated. But
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, when you're dealing with hearsay, I think the sheriff has an obligation to try to determine the truth. I mean, we've got better things to do than to just sit around and deny concealed handgun licenses for something to occupy our time. I think any sheriff in this state would be absolutely remiss if they did not assign one of their investigators to go out and find out what the truth is. I mean, we have to have probable cause in order to take a matter before the court, so therefore, if you have hearsay information from someone that's upset about an issue, I want to know what's truth and what's fact. And if I can show that it is just hearsay and somebody else is just, you know, making up some stuff because they want to see, you know, Bill loses CHL, then I have issues with that. So I think hearsay needs to be investigated to determine what the truth is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Both the sheriffs maybe. What type of training are you getting at BPST regarding this particular part of the law?
He's old. It's DPSST now.
Yeah.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger. I recognize it's been a while since. So I accept that.
Long enough.
Yeah, long enough. But, as far as I know, none. But the thing is that I'd like to go on record and put the Oregon State Sheriff's Association on the spot here, that I'm certainly going to advocate that through the Sheriff's Association that we start training, providing some training to our sheriffs so they can understand what the CHL laws are and have a discussion on discussing some consistency and how these are issued. My understanding of the history of these laws is that it's not something the sheriffs came to the legislature about. As my understanding was representatives from the gun lobby that wanted something because of something that was occurring in fact in Multnomah County. The legislature made the decision, the choice, that this is what we're going to do, and sheriffs, you get to do it. I'd be happy to give it back.
Well, that was my point, Chair, is that it sounds like there's a little bit of a disconnect from the law. What does it really mean? How it's being interpreted from place to place, and definitely an hour class somewhere when we go back for the refresher classes would probably alleviate a lot of the things that are taking place if all officers of all agencies are getting the same message at the academy. I think that would go a long ways to alleviating some of the future problems.
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I would agree. I believe that our field officers and deputies and troopers need to have some additional training that they're not receiving about this because they are engaging individuals, and as you've heard today, in one instance at least there, possibly making some poor decisions, poor choices.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes. This is maybe a little bit off of the topic here, but it was referred to in the testimony, and that is that there's apparently an obligation to pay for the costs, the attorney's fees for a concealed handgun licensee who it prevails in an attempt to revoke the license. And I was looking at the statute, and I found a provision that's in the same section that makes that the case if there's an appeal by the government from a judgment, but I didn't see a provision here that would have that effect if it had been held against the licensee all the way up the line. Or is it a different section? Am I just misreading or not looking at the full range of provisions?
No, Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I've been a sheriff for 20 months. My knowledge of the concealed handgun license laws comes from my chief civil deputy, who's sitting to my left here, Christy Meister, who's been in the business for 28 years. I've been informed that whenever we have a person where the sheriff has denied or revoked a license and the person has appealed, if the sheriff loses, the sheriff pays. That's been how it's been practically applied, is my understanding.
Okay. Follow, Mr. Chair?
Please.
We have another proposal that we've looked at recently in our Judiciary Committee relating to when the state agency is obligated to pay the costs of a litigant, and there's been a lot of refinement of that issue, and it's basically it turns on whether there's any substantial basis for the action taken by by the governmental, the state, in that case, state agency. I'm just wondering, as a policy matter, it seems a little odd to me that it's a without it would be a different standard for this area of activity. And I wonder if you could comment on whether you think that's good policy or not.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I'm not in a position to comment on that. I guess the extent of my knowledge is, as I stated earlier.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to talk about attorney's fees, but are there any questions from the panel?
Chair Barker, if I may, under let me find it here, section 3 of ORS 166293, subsection 9 states filing fees for action shall be as for any civil action filed in the court. If the petitioner prevails, the amount of filing fee shall be paid by the respondent to the petitioner and may be incorporated into the court order.
Good.
That's the filing fee, which is different from the attorney fees. The filing fee is probably a fairly nominal amount as compared to attorney fees. I mean, the only provision I see here that would obligate the government to pay would be if there were a judgment that the government is appealing under sub 12, unless there's another provision entirely separate in the ORS that would give rise to that obligation.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, my chief civil deputy advises that the Lincoln County Court at least is providing for attorney fees in their order, which is allowed for by statute. Well, maybe not in statute, but I retract that statement.
It's not my area of practice at all, but I would say that if the basis for that is 166.293 sub 9, I don't see the basis for including attorney's fees. Anyway, as I said, it's a bit of a digression. It's really only because the comment was made earlier in your presentation about the there being an obligation to pay attorney's fees.
Yeah. Thank you, Carol. I'd like to do something a little different than we normally do. Normally, before we do anything, we have it all completed. But even though, unfortunately, we may be here in session longer than I hoped for, we're starting to run out of time on these, and I don't want to stall this any longer. So what I'd like to do is have a motion to move this forward, the recent version of amendments, and council has been duly charged with having those ready to go, and we'll have them first thing in the morning before the full committee, the full corrected piece of paper, so to speak. So
okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I would... go ahead.
Okay, yes, that's right. Work session.
We'll close that and
we'll
talk in.
Okay. Perfect. Well, we were in a hearing.
We were in Mr. Work Chair, session. I would move House Bill 2768 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation with the understanding that the mentioned amendments are reviewed by all those involved and approved by that.
Okay, and I want to just once again repeat the thanks to the people who, in the firearms people, the sheriffs, especially Representative Olson and Ms. Mowat for their diligent work in getting this thing hammered out. It's, everybody knows anything, first time you say firearm, it becomes very difficult to put the next word on that bill. So, call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative Olson will carry. We'll have those amendments first thing in the morning for people to see. No further business before the committee. Stand adjourned.